So we're going to continue with an open-hearted life. Also in Britain and Australia and India, it's under the title of Living with an Open Heart. So, but it's the same book. So before we continue on with that, let's just take a minute. Yeah, come back to our breath. Is that our motivation? So let's remember that we're doing this to generate transformative methods for compassionate living so that we can improve ourselves and open our hearts in a way that benefits ourselves and all other living beings. And especially to overcome anger, judgment, using people, and really develop love, wishing all beings to have happiness and its causes, and compassion, wishing them to be free of suffering and its causes. And of course, our long-term goal is to become fully awakened Buddhists. So what we're doing today is taking one more step going in that direction. And then through taking the one step of listening to teachings today, then we'll be able to reflect on them at home, meditate on them, put them into practice, and the accumulation of virtue continues on from there. So let's make that as our motivation today. So this book was written by Dr. Russell Coltz, who's a clinical psychologist and a professor at Eastern Washington University, and me. And so the last few chapters we've been doing, well, the last one was Russell's chapter, but before that there were a series of chapters by me. So now that we're getting into a series of chapters by Russell, okay? So that's the way we did the book. He wrote part of it. I wrote part of it. We tried to, you know, we decided on the topics and the subjects and then divided it up. Okay, so we're on chapter 33 today. If you can find all the preceding chapters online on the Srivastava Abbey YouTube station, right? And so there should be at least 32 of them, but they're all comparatively short talks. Okay, so this is chapter 33 called Compassion and Empathy. So empathy is a core component of compassion, both in being able to feel compassion and in acting skillfully upon our compassionate intentions. So it's not enough to feel compassion. We have to know how to act with compassion and make sure our actions are skillful, are suitable. Because sometimes we get so excited with our compassion that we want to convert everybody to compassion right away. And not everybody is interested. So We have to learn how to be skillful, yeah? And also in helping people, not everybody wants the help we want to give them, okay? So again, it's a thing of learning how to put our compassion in action in a way so that it can be received. If not now, then at least by planting seeds in the other person so that at a later time when they're more receptive, they might think about what they hear now and learn more about it. Okay, empathy enables us to understand what another person is feeling and to know what actions are most likely to be helpful in specific situations. Without empathy, our efforts to act with compassion will likely be doomed to fail because without understanding the experiences of others, it is almost impossible to give them what they need. So we really need to understand people's experience, yeah? And to do that, we need to understand the culture in which they grew up. We need to understand maybe some things about their family background. We need to understand what they've gone through in their lives or possibly have gone through in their lives and understand their interests and, you know, understand where they get stuck and where they can really excel. Yeah. So, we hardly know all of that even about ourselves, let alone knowing all of that for another individual. Not to mention the fact that all these things are constantly changing and in flux. Okay? But the more we understand our own mind, the easier it becomes to understand other people's minds and how they could possibly be thinking and feeling. But we shouldn't assume that we understand that, okay? Because people come into this life with a very different karma, and the conditioning we receive in this life, depending on our family, our culture, our nationality, the historical time that we're born in and live in, all of that conditioning really affects how a person thinks right now. Yeah. So we can kind of infer some of it from what we know about ourselves, but we have to really pay attention to where other people are at right now. Yeah. Okay. And I think this is part of the challenge to Americans right now with, you know, the civil rights issue again coming up because it wasn't resolved previously. And so how everybody can learn to listen to other people who grew up in different ways than they did. Okay. So Russell continues. Here he's speaking about a client of his named Rebecca. Of course, he changed the names. Okay. So Rebecca discussed having this experience with her mother. She said, "I know she cared for me, but she didn't seem to have a clue about what I needed or wanted. On birthdays, she'd make a big show of taking me to an amusement park or noisy restaurant, things she liked and wished she'd been able to do when growing up. She didn't consider that I hated those things and that I'd have preferred a quiet outing with a few close friends. I can't count the times she handed me money when I needed a hug." Okay. So Russell comments, "Rebecca's mother tried very hard to care for her, but because she wasn't good at empathy, She couldn't understand what Rebecca needed, and so she couldn't be there for Rebecca in ways that would have been really helpful to her. Okay? So I want to comment on this, because this is, you know, this was my experience also with my parents. They just didn't get where I was at and what I needed and how I felt and so on. And I think, you know, that often happens in families. But as I grew older, I also realized I didn't understand where they were coming from. And I had my list of, if they really loved me and understood me, they would do 1, 2, 3, 4, which of course they didn't do. So I assume they didn't really understand me and love me the way I wanted to be loved. But you know what I discovered as I got older? Part of the problem was me. Because I wanted them to show their love for me in a certain way, and they didn't do it. So I couldn't see the love that they were giving me. Okay? So as I grew older, I opened more to the fact that people are going to show love in a way that feels most comfortable for them. And it would be wonderful if they had empathy for me and gave the love in by doing the actions that I think are showing love. But that's not really a very fair demand for me to put on somebody else. Okay? Because surely I don't show love and affection to other people exactly as the way they want it. And yet I would like to know that they receive the love that I give them. Okay? So it's a twofold thing here of trying to be empathetic towards others, but also, you know, our empathy towards others also includes that the way they respond for us to understand the way they respond, and without a mind that demands that they respond with certain actions and behavior that I deem appropriate or what I want. Yeah. And I really noticed this. I've spent many years living into the Tibetan community. And Tibetan, you know, in the West, we create closeness with other people by talking about our feelings, our experiences, our trials, our struggles, and things like that. We talk on an emotional level, and that really creates a lot of bonds. In Tibetan culture, that's not how the people bond. They don't talk about their emotions like that. The way they bond is they do something for somebody. They cook a meal. They help them carry something. They go get the water. Yeah, they run an errand. They do tasks and chores. And that's how they show that they care for somebody. And that's how they create trust and bonding. It's very different how we do. Yeah. So I had to really open myself to that fact with my Tibetan friends. Yeah. And, because I'm sure if I started talking about all my emotional stuff and thoughts about different things, they would like, what, huh? Why is she telling me all this? This is personal stuff. That's not how you bond. Okay. So, yeah, so this empathy is not always so clear. Yeah. I would say, So compassion isn't just about good intentions. If we are to skillfully act on our motivation, we must make the effort to understand the feelings and experiences of others and to accept them as valid. Then we'll know what they really need and we'll be better equipped to provide it. Okay? So for example, some people, when they're sick, they want to be pampered. They want you to come in their room, you know, every hour, check on them. How are you? Let me fluff your pillow. What do you need? Can I get you anything? Okay. Other people, when they're sick, they really just want to be left alone so they can sleep and rest. Okay. So there isn't just one way that people are sick. And if we want to show compassion for somebody, yeah, we have to figure out their particular way of being sick and what really meets their needs. Yeah? Okay. So similarly, some people, when they aren't feeling well, they want advice. Other people, advice is the last thing they want. Okay? So you may want to give them advice, and you may have good advice, and your advice may be much better than what they're doing. But if they don't want to hear it, yeah, you're talking to empty space. Yeah? And so there, you know, we have to match our behavior with what is they're really needing and wanting at that time. Needing is according to what they think they need, not according to what we think they need. Because we think they need to do certain things. They think, no. And it's really tough. I know with my parents when they were getting older, trying to get my dad not to drive, oh my goodness, he did not want to hear that. Because for him, you know, driving was being a competent adult and having independence. And when we kids started saying, but dad, you don't see so well, your reactions aren't so fast now, it was like that was the wrong thing to say. He did not want to hear that. And he couldn't hear anything we said after that about the danger of him driving. So empathy wasn't what giving him what we think he needed, which was stop driving, Dad, because it's dangerous for you and other people. We had to give him what he think he needed, yeah. And so eventually, kind of what we settled on was, Dad, you've been chauffeuring us around all these years, and it's really tiring doing all the driving. You know, let's let us repay your kindness and take you places now. So that kind of worked a little bit as we slowly, you know, got into this transition and role reversal that comes, you know, when parents age and they're no longer taking care of you, but you're taking care of them. Yeah. But of course, when you're a parent, you always feel like you should take care of your children. And you always try to. And the kids don't always want advice. But I must say, my dad handled it very well when he was in his 60s and my grandma would tell him to put on a sweater so he didn't catch cold. Yeah, he didn't get mad. He just accepted it and kept going, you know, and interpreted it as a mark of her love for him, even though he was a grandfather at that time himself. Okay? We sentient beings are pretty funny, aren't we? The way we operate. So empathy requires us to be emotionally attuned to another person and to use our reasoning to consider the nuances of their experience. With empathic understanding, we seek to grasp both what the person is feeling and the validity of their emotional experience, how it makes sense that they might feel and behave in this way. So we may not think their emotional experience and their behavior is accurate, but we have to understand why for them it is valid and look at the situation as they do. Because if we're constantly telling them that their understanding of their own experience is invalid, then they're not going to feel heard. Okay. Our mirror neurons, cells in our brain that lead us to feel a bit of what others we are in contact with are feeling, help with this by giving us a taste of the other person's emotional experience. However, we don't want to get caught up in our own emotional reactions to what they are going through, but to use this taste as a clue to what the other person may be feeling. Sometimes we get so involved in thinking about what they're going through now that we get distressed. And then we share our anxiety about their life with them, which doesn't help them at all. It makes them only more anxious. Okay, so if you're somebody who tends towards anxiety, be really aware of this when you're cultivating empathy and trying to act in a compassionate way. Make sure that your mind is focused on the other person's experience and that you're not getting so caught up in what they're feeling that you're in personal distress yourself, and then your behavior comes out as trying to control the other person's life so that they won't experience what they're experiencing that makes you so emotionally distressed. Okay? So, you know, try and set that anxiety aside. So with empathy, our focus is on developing an understanding of the other person's emotional experience and then checking out our understanding with them to make sure we're on the right track. Again, the focus is on their experience. And so it's always good to check out what we're understanding with the other person. Yeah, and this is where nonviolent communication is really helpful, because there we ask questions. We don't make statements, you know, like, it sounds like you're really angry and upset about that. Is that how you're feeling? Instead of, you're angry and upset, and don't you know if you're a good Buddhist, you shouldn't feel like that? Yeah. Okay, so, really checking out our understanding with them. And when we do, if we've missed the boat, they'll correct us. And if we've gotten it right, very often it opens the door and they will share more about what they're feeling. Okay, so here are some tips for developing empathic understanding. Okay, so one, pay attention to the other person's nonverbal behavior. What does their facial expression, tone of voice, and how they move or position their bodies tell us about what they might be feeling? So you're talking to someone and they're sitting like this. What is that telling you? Yeah, they may not be so open. They're feeling a bit defensive. Yeah, and need to protect themselves. And it's kind of an assertive defensive posture that's saying, don't get on my case, isn't it? Yeah. If you were sitting like this, it means something else. Yeah. This is, you know, I'm defensive, but I'm completely defeated. This is, your arm's in the same place. I'm defensive, but get off my case. Okay. So, you know, we have to pay attention to that kind of thing. And also pay attention to when the person, what the person is saying isn't always matching what they're talking about. I'll give you an example. Many years ago, I was in Israel teaching. And that is a country where I would say most people have PTSD. Yeah, of some kind or another. Anyway, I was talking to a young man who had, been in the Israeli army, because both the men and women go in the army. And he was in a commando. And so they were doing some special operation in Lebanon. This was many years ago. I don't know what operation they were doing, but it was some secret thing, and it was extremely dangerous. So I asked him about his experience, what it was like to be a commando in a dangerous situation. And he's telling me about his experience doing these very dangerous things, and he's smiling. Yeah? And I'm going, whoa! A smile is not matching what he's telling me, because it was clear what he's telling me. It was very frightening and very scary. And he was not at all happy doing that. Yeah. But he's smiling while telling me. So that's telling me something about how he related to his own experience and how difficult it was for him to process that experience and reconcile it. Okay? So there's many things that we pick up non-verbally, from people, from how they're sitting, watching their facial expressions. Yeah. Watching where their eyes go. If their eyes are down, if their head is down, or if their eyes are up and they're reflecting on something and processing something. Yeah. So there's so much we can learn that way. We can also learn by seeing how people are breathing. Yeah. If people are breathing, you know something's going on. Yeah. If people are breathing more slowly, you know that they're more relaxed with what they're telling you. Okay. So there's many things to be sensitive to and aware. And sometimes when you're really trying to communicate with somebody, if you can match their breathing, it creates a nonverbal bond with that person. Yeah. That neither of you may be consciously aware of. But if you can match their breathing pattern, it brings some closeness there. Okay, another tip for empathic understanding. Consider how you might feel or have felt in similar situations. So consider that, but remember, it can inform you, but it may not be exactly the same as the other person's experience. Then three, consider that this person is different from you in many ways. How might their experience differ from your own? Okay, so be aware of that. Yeah. And another one, if you're wondering how others are feeling, consider asking them. Yeah? It's like, duh. But often the simple comment, "I'm wondering how you are feeling about all of this," will lead others to tell us exactly how they feel. Yeah, so I'm wondering how you're feeling. You know, how's this going down with you? Spoken kindly, it also communicates compassion that we care about how they feel. So that means that we also have to pay attention to our voice. How are you feeling about all of this? Conveys something different than, how are you feeling about all of this? Okay, so it's not just the words, it's how they've said. And this is what gets lost in emails and text messages. And that's why it's so easy to have a misunderstanding with people through those written communications, because the voice, the facial expression, tell us so much about what the person's really meaning. Okay, then check out your understanding to make sure you've got it right. Remember, the other person is the expert of her or his own experience. And it is never our place to tell someone else what he or she or is or should be feeling. And we go wrong on that sometimes. You know, we have our own diagnosis of somebody, and it could be way off. And even if our diagnosis is right, if the other person sees their situation differently, we can bring about more communication if we simply accept their way of seeing their situation as a valid way for them in terms of how they grew up and how they process things. Yeah. So Russell's saying, you can say, it seems like you're feeling frustrated about this situation. Is that right? Yeah, so ask them what they're feeling. Yeah. I remember one situation myself where I responded way too quickly to what somebody else said based on my wish to correct their gender-biased comment. But in doing so, I did not say the right thing, and it was not at all skillful. And I don't know how the person took it. They never said anything afterwards, but I imagine now it was hurtful. So I'll tell you the situation. I was with some volunteers. We went into a prison in, I can't even remember what state it was in now. It wasn't Washington State, somewhere else in the country. And I was with some prison volunteers. I didn't know those particular volunteers, you know, because I was teaching at the Dharma Center in the area and then linked with them to go in and talk to the Buddhist group. And when we were coming out, because I think it had been a high-max prison, and one of the volunteers I was with, he said, you know, a lot of those men in the prison have been raped and have been sexually violated, and it's especially difficult for a man to be raped. Well, my first reaction was, oh, so you think raping women is okay? And men feel more pain than women do when they're raped? You know, why are you making a comment like that? You know, this is where I went. Like, I've got to correct his gender bias right then and there, because he was dismissing women's experience. So I said, I opened my big mouth, and I said that, basically. I said, oh, you think men are more distressed after being raped than women? Women are raped much more often than men, and men tend to just ignore the pain that they inflict on women. I said something like that, in that tone of voice, because I was not going to put up with any nonsense from this guy. And then I realized after I said that, that I think he, as a child, had been sexually molested. And what he was saying was actually speaking of his own experience, even though the words were talking about the men that we had just seen in the high max prison. So I said totally the wrong thing that was not showing any empathy or compassion for his personal experience. And if I had wanted him to really understand what women went through, first, I needed to show compassion and empathy through for what he had experienced. And I missed the boat, because I was, you know, what everybody is nowadays. What do we do? What do we call it? Confronting people. Yeah. So I was going to confront him. Yeah. That wasn't a skillful thing or a compassionate thing to do in that situation. Okay. Russell continues here. As a therapist, almost never, almost never say the phrase, I understand, to my clients. And I train my students to avoid using it as well. I know one person, whenever I talk to her, her thing is, I understand, dear. I understand. I understand. And what Russell says here pertains. So why does he discourage people from saying that? This phrase sets others up to think, you don't understand at all. How could you? You're not me, and you haven't been through what I've been through. Okay? So saying I understand is often not the right thing to say. And I know from something, you know, last year, somebody was telling me about my experience growing up as a white American. And I was going, you do not understand me. Yeah. Because they were saying, well, you grew up just like I grew up in this kind of community and this kind of experience. And it was like, no, I didn't grow up having your same experience growing up. I'm from a minority group. You know, I grew up with a totally different experience than you did. Yeah. So that's why telling other people what they feel based on your experience isn't always the best thing to do. Okay. I got quite upset, angry, actually. Okay, now it's over. It's like, forget it. Don't expect other people to understand you. Okay, so Russell continues. And they'd be right if we, you know, if the other person said to us, you don't understand me. Instead, my goal is to make my best attempt to understand their experience and then to demonstrate my understanding by checking it out with them and responding helpfully and appropriately in our interactions. When it comes to understanding the emotions of others, it can be better to show them rather than to tell them that we understand. Knowing that emotions can be very powerful in organizing our mental experience and motivating our behavior, empathic understanding offers us a gateway to compassion. Once we understand the factors that led to them, behaviors we previously might have thought were crazy, nasty, or irritating can suddenly make a whole lot of sense. And we can find our judgments melting away, replaced by compassion. And so the same thing applies in, quote, quote, talking to ourselves and understanding ourselves. We may have a behavior that we continue doing, which we know is harmful and not at all productive. But we keep doing it. And then, of course, we criticize ourselves and we tell ourselves what lousy people we are because we keep doing this and how much we want to stop, but we don't stop. So just as here, the thing, what Russell is saying with other people, try to understand their background, the experiences in their life, their conditioning, so that what they're doing makes sense to you in the context of what they're dealing with. In the same way, give that space to ourselves and investigate, you know, okay, I'm doing this behavior. What am I really trying to say when I do it? What am I really needing when I do this? So instead of criticizing ourselves, look at me, I'm doing that behavior again, I'm overeating, I'm doing blah, 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 I shouldn't do it, what a stupid person I am. Instead of that, be a bit kind to ourselves. And like, okay, with that behavior, I'm trying to say something. I'm trying to meet some kind of need. Yeah, what is it that I'm really saying at that time? What is it I'm really needing? And with that kind of compassionate, kind, empathic, approach to ourselves, then give ourselves some space to really find out, you know, what am I trying to get out of doing this behavior? Because if I can meet that need in another way, then I won't be doing that behavior. And I'll feel a lot better about myself. Okay? So having that same kind of, you know, looking at our own conditioning, yeah, or just looking at our own emotional makeup. What afflictions are really strong in us? What emotional needs are very strong in us? And acknowledging what they are. And then, you know, seeing, well, okay, how can I work with that? So that I could at least stop the behavior that is amplifying my craziness in this moment. And, you know, try and deal and meet the need that I'm feeling in some other way. Okay. During a group therapy session, I, Russell, was facilitating at an inpatient adolescent psychiatric treatment center. The teenagers were discussing how things had been going over the last week. One of the group members spoke about another resident, Gregor, who was not a member of that group that he was talking to, who was from another country, had a heavy accent, and hadn't formed many friendships with other kids since he'd been admitted. The discussion focused on Gregor getting into trouble for digging through garbage bins in the facility's dining hall, removing food and stashing it in his room. As the discussion began, the teenagers were laughing and making fun of him for his gross behavior, which seemed so bizarre to them. As the gossip continued, another group member, Mark, spoke up and said, "I think it's gross too. It bothered me so much that I talked to him. Man, why are you digging food out of the trash? That's nasty." And you know what he said? Gregor said where he came from, there was hardly any food. His family would go days without having no food to eat. Immediately, the mood in the group shifted. The room quieted as ridicule was replaced with empathy and compassion, as the harsh reality of Gregor's life sank in. "I've had to go hungry sometimes. It was terrible." You know, this is the thoughts of the other group members. "I didn't know that. Poor guy." Mark continued, "It's like Gregor's always scared that he won't have food to eat, so he hides it. He even gets mad at himself, says he knows it's not true, but he's still scared. It's like he can't help it." Feeling pleased and moved by their compassion, I sat back and watched as this group of adolescents, all of whom had experienced very difficult lives themselves, decided as a group to stop making fun of Gregor and to reach out to him in friendship. This is the power of empathy to create compassion. Once they learned about and understood Gregor's fears, compassion arose within them, and they immediately acted upon it by stopping their ridicule and by committing to treat him with kindness. Okay. One time when I was in Israel, I was talking to some of the young Israelis whose parents or grandparents had been in the Holocaust, or in this particular case of the person I'm going to talk about, I think his parents, I don't know, they might have been to the through in the camps, and then after the 1945, they immigrated to South America. And so they were very poor moving to South America. And then finally, when they were able to immigrate to Israel, they did that. Okay? So he was, my friend was talking about how his parents, the freezer at his parents' house is always completely full of food, more food than they could eat in, you know, a couple of weeks. And, you know, and as soon as one thing was taken out, it was immediately replaced by two more things, so that the freezer was always filled. And he was commenting, you know, "I understand, you know, I look at it and I think it's kind of crazy. We don't need to do that now. But my parents went through times when they didn't have food. And this behavior for them makes total sense. And it gives them a feeling of security that they never had when they were younger." And I thought that was really beautiful, how he had that understanding for his folks, instead of going home and like, "Mom and Dad, what are you doing storing all this food and hoarding it? you know, we have plenty of food now. You don't need to do this. You know, instead of that, he was completely understanding of, you know, his parents' fears. Yeah. Okay, so here's the reflection on empathy. So recall a time when you were judgmental towards another person. Can you think about a time when you were judgmental? Yeah, you probably had 5 or 6 instances today before we even got here, you know. Maybe a few yesterday, maybe some big ones from before. Think about what the other person was saying or doing that disturbed you so much, and consider what might they have been feeling that could have led them to act or speak in that way. If you know even a little about that person's life, consider what they may have experienced and how they that might have affected them. Okay. Think about how you would have felt in that situation and let your heart open in empathy, releasing the rigid judgment and replacing it with compassion. Okay. Also, I'm going to add another thing to consider in this reflection. Many of us who are verbally fluent in naming our emotions and feeling comfortable about talking about them, we have to realize that not everybody knows even how to label what they're feeling. And even if they know how to label it, not everybody feels comfortable talking about their feelings. I realized through a discussion with one friend of mine, she was telling me that, you know, in her family, they never labeled feelings. You know, you might have been a little kid crying because you couldn't get the apple juice you wanted. But nobody ever said, oh, you're frustrated because you can't get what you want. So she never learned to identify that feeling as frustration. Yeah? Or some other kid may be angry and upset, and the parent just says, shut up. But they don't, you know, because for kids to learn language and to know what experiences match with what words, they need an adult to say, oh, I know you're angry, but, you know, we have to do this at this time. Or I know that you're really attached to having that, or that you really want to be with this person now, but that's not possible. Or, you know, to explain in words, to reflect to young children when they're growing up, not just this young, but this young, you know, when they're bigger too, the emotions that you think they're having so that they will learn what names to give what they're feeling. Because, and this was a shock to me to learn, but it explained a lot that some people don't have the vocabulary. They never learned it in their family. Yeah. Once I realized, oh my goodness, that helped me to be a lot more patient and understanding with people when I would ask, what are you feeling? And they couldn't tell me. And also to realize that some people don't feel comfortable talking about emotions. This is the next step. They may know what their emotion is, but they don't feel comfortable talking about it. And I think men, especially, They, you know, the way they're raised is you're not supposed to feel emotions. And when you do, you're not supposed to talk about them. Okay. What was that video we watched? The mask we live in. Okay. Excellent video. I really highly recommend it. The masks we live in. Because it was talking about how men are raised and the masks that they are told to create for themselves to be a man. Yeah. And if we can understand this about people, we can understand how difficult it can be for people to speak about their emotions. Yeah. That's my addition to Russell's reflection. Then he continues, make an effort to practice empathy during your daily life. As you go through the day interacting with other people, pause and consider their emotional experience. What might this person be feeling? Using the suggestions described above, try to develop an understanding of what others might be feeling and practice checking out your understanding with them, asking them if, you know, what you think they're feeling is what's actually happening for them. Okay. So we have a little bit of time for questions and comments. Yeah.
Two questions online. So the first is from Ariane. She was saying that Russell's advice earlier, it sounded like reflective listening to her or active listening with empathy. Mm-hmm. And then so she's asking, does empathy keep one's ego all about me out of the interaction?
Empathy helps a lot to keep our own ego out of it. Because with empathy, we're trying to understand the other person's experience, which means our focus is on them. It's not on us. Okay? So we have to put our own feelings and needs aside at that moment and really listen from our heart to what the other person's saying, without judging it.
And then Scarlett in, I believe it was Switzerland, she's asking, how can you deal with the feeling of being ignored and hurt when you try to help someone and the person doesn't listen to you? But if someone else tells her the same thing, then they agree. Do you keep offering your help anyway? Or do you not do anything if they don't ask you actively?
I think... Yeah, how many of us have had that experience? Yeah, I think everybody. Okay, how many of us have been the person shunning one person's advice and taking the other person's advice, even though the advice was the same? Oh, why did we do that? Why did we ignore one person's advice and listen to somebody else who said the same thing? Pride. Okay.
Sometimes being heard by one and not the other.
Yeah. Sometimes if we feel heard by the other person, we will listen to them. Whereas not feeling heard by another person, we won't listen to them.
Yeah, trust.
Like
I know they've had that experience.
Yeah. Or I know they understand. I know they've had that experience. Yeah. Oh, and sometimes, actually, it's true. People need to hear the advice more than once. So it could be that if you were the second person who came around, they might be listening to you after not having listened to the first person who was the second person in your present experience. But I think there is often an element of pride. I know my own experience well. Don't you tell me. Yeah. or you think you're superior to me and can give me advice that I didn't ask for. Okay? So there's many possible things in it, yeah? But in terms of the question, okay, that person has had the experience of trying to help somebody, it being rebuffed, somebody else comes along, offers the same thing, and it's accepted. And then she's asking me, or he, who's of her, she, what do I do? Do I continue to help or not help? Let's back up a little bit. Instead of asking, what do I do? Let's first figure out, how do you feel? Because unless you understand how you feel, you won't be able to figure out what to do in a skillful way. Okay? So when you're the person who, out of kindness and care for somebody, have offered advice, the other person ignores you, you know, or even tells you to get out of there. Somebody else comes along, offers the same advice, and you learn about it because the person did it. How, if that happened to you, how do you think you would feel?
If you genuinely were giving out of kindness, you would be okay with it.
Okay. If you were genuinely giving out of kindness, it wouldn't matter to you. You'd be fine that they listened to somebody else and not you. So what's it telling you about your own motivation? Yeah, there's some element of our own motivation that is self-serving. We have an agenda for the other person. Yeah, and we are confident, maybe a little arrogant, that we know what is best for them. And when they rebuff it, we feel misunderstood. We're not understood.
Discounted,
frustrated, ignored. Okay. So we feel a lot of pain. Does the other person recognize that we may feel pain because of their reaction to our attempt to help them? No, they don't understand. No, it may be obvious, but your reaction is, well, beep, 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 you know, if you hadn't opened your big mouth and interfered in the situation where your advice wasn't called for, you wouldn't feel so bad because I rejected it. So they don't really understand, do they? So you have two people, neither of them having much understanding of the other person's feelings. Yeah, very ripe for some conflict. Yeah? So I know personally speaking, when that has happened to me, you know, instead of getting involved in, I'm discounted, I'm ignored, I'm frustrated, I'm not understood, because that's all about me, to say, oh, you know, when I gave them that advice, I had some genuine care for them. I mean, they're a friend. I genuinely care. And I also had my own agenda about what I thought was the right way to deal with the situation. And I wasn't respecting the fact that they might have their own ideas about how to deal with it. So I'm going to learn from this situation and try in the future to have a more empathic and compassionate motivation, and sometimes maybe not give my advice, even though it looks to me like the other person is not making a very wise decision. You know, but because my advice is tinted with my agenda and expectations of them, I need to work a bit on my motivation here. Yeah. And if I do that, if I accept responsibility for my part of it, then I no longer feel misunderstood or discounted, because I realized that if I had had a more open-minded awareness of the situation, you know, then I wouldn't have been forcing my advice on somebody. Yeah. And they wouldn't then have reacted the way they did. Yeah. And then I can sit there and go, but I am still so frustrated because what they're doing is so stupid. Well, chill out. You know, sometimes we just have to tell ourselves to chill out.
She clarified that this is her mother she's talking about.
Oh, yes. It often happens with mothers. Yeah? And it happens, mothers feeling that way with kids. When you have a child who's a young adult, yeah, my sister just wrote me, you know, and you watch your young adult kids make decisions that you don't consider especially wise decisions. In this case, it wasn't about her own kids that my sister wrote me. But I have really nice nieces and nephews. Because they're mine, so they're really nice. And it's my sister, and so she's a really wonderful person because she's my sister. Okay, so we got that. but, you know, she was sitting there watching young adults that she cared about making life, you know, big decisions about their life that she didn't consider were very wise. And what do you do? Yeah, when you know, I mean, we've all been through that late teen, early, mid, late 20s thing of don't tell me what to do. If you're older than me, I don't want to hear it. Yeah, so, you know, what do you do as a parent who cares about their kid when you know the kid can't listen to you? Yeah. This is why, as a parent, if you're smart, when your kids are growing up, help them to develop very close relationships with other adults. Yeah. Because then when they reach this age and they can't hear anything their parents are saying to them, they will still trust these other adults, and they'll go to them to complain about you not understanding them. But the other adult can then give them advice and understanding which they will listen to. Yeah. So sometimes we have to be aware that we are not the best person to give somebody else advice. You know, in the case of my dad stopping driving, having three kids sit around him and tell him that, no, you know, if one of his friends who was about the same age were to say, I stopped driving and it's really wonderful, oh, then dad would have, you know, lapped it up. It would have been an easy deal. But we didn't understand that. Yeah. But what I did see with my dad is, you know, as he aged, he really needed a lot of help physically to do things. He did not want me to help. Absolutely, positively. I couldn't even help him get in or out of a car. He did not want any help from me. But he would accept help from my sister. And when my friends would come and we'd all go out to lunch, my friends could help my dad in and out of the car. My friends could help my dad with the walker. My friends could do all this. I didn't even try anymore because he didn't want me to. Okay? So sometimes you just have to give into the situation. Yeah. And do what actually the other person feels comfortable with, not what we want. Yeah. Okay.